From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Kojo Namdi Show. I'm Rebecca Roberts, sitting in for Kojo. Coming up this hour on the Kojo Namdi Show, new revelations on the life and death and lasting local impact of Abraham Lincoln. Later in the broadcast, we'll talk with a local historian about the dark days following his assassination and how a brutal justice system treated conspirators. But first, a look at the nation's 16th president as the country's first technology geek in chief. Lincoln was the first and only president to hold a patent. And from his earliest days in Washington, he understood the impact new gadgets and gizmos could have on a country at war. He test-fired machine guns on the White House lawn. He championed early surveillance balloons and Ironside warships. And he recognized the broader potential for railroads and telegraphs. It's a story told by a father-son history team who join me now in the studio, Thomas Allen and Roger McBride Allen, co-authors of Mr. Lincoln's High-Tech War. Welcome, both of you, to the program.
Thank you.
You can join us by calling 800-433-8850 or send us email kojo@wamu.org. So we are talking about President Lincoln as a tech geek. Of course, that is within mid-19th century parameters. But you start the book by talking about how until that age, technology changed very little and then changed so quickly that Lincoln's great-grandfather would not have had a hard time recognizing Lincoln's childhood, but by Lincoln's adulthood, it was totally unrecognizable. Mm-hmm. And even with all of that change, it takes a certain kind of president or a certain kind of leader in any form to recognize the benefits of it, right? You can be a Luddite or just not understand where these things can lead you. What do you suppose it was about Lincoln that left him receptive to these things? Tom, let's start with you.
Well, he was also someone who was seeing the wilderness and the frontier change. And he was a lawyer, and we find that he goes to a small town in Illinois one time when he was on his practice, and he sees someone operating a telegraph. And he talks to the telegraph operator, and he's fascinated by what's a telegraph all about. It would be almost as if you had someone who knew there was such a thing as television, but they had no idea how it worked. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to know how it worked. And he had a great understanding of gadgetry. His partner talks about, he was always talking about and writing about. At one point, he even had a kind of lecture that he gave about the promise of the future. Well, this was all long before he became president.
Well, the telegraph specifically seems to have been something of an obsession. He strung had a wire strung to the War Office.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. One of the things that's I become fond of saying is Obama is to the BlackBerry. Lincoln is to the telegraph. He ran the war from the War Office. He would go over there virtually every day during the war, sit down, read the telegraphs that had come in, and he would send queries, he would send orders, he would ask for clarification, he would say, do you have a plan, what is your plan, send your troops here and send there. He was really operating the war from the war room. You have to be careful not to overstate and overgeneralize, but in large case, that was what was going on. And he was hands-on. He was the commander-in-chief in name rather than as some sort of honorary title, which had always been the case.
Well, give us some sense of how it happened before then. Say, the War of 1812, how were orders sent to the field?
They barely were.
Yeah. The president was really out of the picture. The commander-in-chief was an honorific, mostly. And so the commanding general would be the guy who would be running the war. And he'd be running it pretty much the way it was run in the Revolution. You send out a dispatch rider with your orders, and it would go through a hierarchy, and finally on a battlefield somewhere, someone is getting some orders. And, of course, it would have been garbled 14 different ways, or maybe the guy who carried the orders was intercepted and a false order was given to him. It was all pieces of paper.
And by the time you got there, the circumstance had changed completely. Yeah. In the War of 1812, the big American victory happened after the war ended, that the big battle we won, because no one had gotten word to the guys on the other side the war was over.
Yeah. So there was this tremendous delay, and he instantly saw the fact that, as Raj said, I mean, he can sit here in the war room, and there are these wonderful telegrams where, you know, there's some colonel somewhere gets something that's signed A. Lincoln, and it's saying, did you take that hill yet? Or I haven't heard for there's one message where, you know, I haven't heard from you in 20 minutes or something like that. I mean, he is in instantaneous commanding. And
Which changes executive power as
well. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Hugely.
Yeah. He's the guy you have to listen to. And it's a whole new experience for generals. They didn't have to listen to anybody before.
Well, we referred to him as the only president to hold a patent, and his patent was for floating boats above a rocky shoal, right?
Well, because he got stuck in that situation. One of the things that I think drives Lincoln's belief in technology is, for example, when he was a teenager, a young boy, he was basically farmed out by his father. He was sent as a work animal to go work at someone else's farm to pay off his father's debt. He didn't like physical labor, and these machines eliminated physical labor. He sailed flatboats around to sell things and raise money. That was one of his jobs. His boat got stuck. And so he was very interested in figuring out ways to not have your boat stuck. And he got a patent for a device that wasn't practical. He didn't sell any. It wasn't a commercial success. But he was working at ways to solve that problem using gadgets, machines, levers, pulleys, to do what needed to be done.
There's an email here from Patty who says, didn't Thomas Jefferson invent some interesting things? Why didn't he have a patent?
Well, you got to ask Thomas Jefferson.
We didn't have a patent office by then.
Yeah. What happens with Lincoln, when he is serving as a congressman here for that one term, he takes his son, Todd, up to the patent office. It's like taking you to a temple. It was even called a temple in its time. It was this great.
Well, it's
big,
now the
beautiful
building museum. Right?
Yeah.
It's an amazing.
No, it's
space.
Now the portrait gallery.
Oh, right.
Yeah. And he goes up and he shows these wonderful little models of various inventions. And he has that on his mind. And he, when he gets to the White House, not only does he have this long time feeling about modernity, but he gets the idea that, you know, Commander in Chief is something I can do. He sends to the Library of Congress for books on military tactics and becomes a reader of military tactics and strategy and starts applying it.
And he also pretty much feels forced into that role because his generals aren't with the program. The
right.
Generals are using tactics that don't work, in effect. They're being very cautious. They're not using the tools at hand, and they're failing. And he, at one point, toys with the idea of actually taking the field, of actually going out to the head of his troops and saying, go over there. And in fact, at one point during the war, he actually directly is commanding the retaking of Norfolk and the Newport News shipyard. He was there on the scene commanding that.
Well, also, he knew he was going to be a wartime president. I mean, Fort
yeah.
Sumter hadn't happened yet. I suppose he could have, during the campaign, hoped that war could have been avoided. But by the time he was actually elected, before he was inaugurated, it was pretty clear he was going to be residing over a wartime country.
Well, he makes that. He also had the strategic idea of letting the South fire the first shot. And it's because he does have a knowledge of how to run things. He lets them, he says, we're not going to send any ammunition. We're going to send some food. We're going to stock the fort, Fort Sumter, but we're not going to put any troops in, and we're not going to put any ammunition in. Well, the South still wants to start, you know, is forced to start the war, and that's what he wanted, and he gets it.
So we've talked a little bit about the telegraph. Some of the other, of course, the flip side of technological improvement is then technological dependency. And
yeah.
It was clear even in the beginning of the war that tearing up railroads and tearing up telegraph lines was a pretty effective tactic. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you get the flip side of it right from the very beginning.
Yeah, one of the first crises of the war, and you could make the case the war hadn't quite started yet. I would differ a little bit with knowing for sure he's going to be a wartime president, because first, no one knew what the shape of the war was going to be. People were imagining it would be quick, it would be short, one side would win, and that would be over, one big battle. But no one understood what the war was going to be like. Lincoln was hoping to find a way to maneuver past it. The possibility was certainly there. But just as the war looked like it was going to happen, the secessionists in Baltimore cut the rail lines and the telegraph lines to Washington, and to a remarkable extent, just cutting those lines isolates Washington totally. It's an island. It is cut off almost absolutely from the north. Washington, no one can really get in or out in any substantial way, because that's the way you bring in practically everything. The only way you get news in and out is through the telegraph. Lincoln's wandering around the White House hoping for reinforcements to come from the north. He has no idea if they're going to arrive or not. He walks around saying to himself, why don't they come? Why don't they come? And it's Dad is more an expert on this part of the story, the way they get there.
Well, they're sending Massachusetts reacts and says, we're sending people to Washington. Washington, as Rod says, has nobody in it.
Right.
All our soldiers are at the end of a long, long telegraph line out in the Indian country. Most of them are out there fighting Indians. There's hardly anybody in Washington to defend the city. I mean, civil workers grab guns and are ready to have a kind of home force to repel the invaders that are either going to come from Virginia or Maryland. When the regiment from Massachusetts comes down to Baltimore, Baltimore has a city ordinance that says you can't have a locomotive go across the center of the city. So you get off, the cars are detached from the car, and horses pull the cars across Baltimore to the other station, and then they put the cars in and start again. So the guys coming in from Massachusetts are forced to, they decide they're going to march, some marching, some getting cars, but the ones who march are given very specific orders. They're carrying loaded weapons, but they're not to use them unless a weapon is used against them. And sure enough, there's a mob. The mob's throwing rocks and throwing bricks, and then finally is firing. And that's the first blood that's shed in the Revolution, in the Civil War.
Civil War, and that was the riot that sparked the lyrics to "Maryland, My Maryland."
Which
I know you all are eager to
sing.
Well, there's a bill in the state legislature to change the lyrics to an 1894 version. That's all about.
One can only hope. The
Verdant
current
hills and stuff.
The current lyrics of the official song of Maryland refer to Abraham Lincoln as a tyrant, a vandal, and a despot, and refer to, I believe it's the 6th Massachusetts Regiment, as Northern Scum. That's the official state document of Maryland making those statements.
We are talking with Tom Allen and Roger Allen, co-authors of Mr. Lincoln's High-Tech War. If you see a parallel between Lincoln the Tech Geek and Obama the Tech Geek, or you have a local anecdote about Lincoln and his imprint in our region, join us, 800-433-8850, or email us, kojo@wamu.org. We'll continue our conversation after this short break. Stay tuned.
Our HD Channel 2, Bluegrass Country, and our HD Channel 3, News Talk, is off the air while we upgrade our HD transmitter. So when you listen to an HD radio, you'll hear WAMU's analog signal on all three HD channels. We're working hard to upgrade our HD transmitter as quickly as possible, and the result of this upgrade will be a more stable HD signal. We regret any inconvenience. You can listen to all three of our HD channels online at WAMU.org.
Next time on Tell Me More, he was a small-town mayor living a quiet life, and then a county SWAT team raided his home, tied him up, and killed his dogs.
I heard my mother-in-law scream, then the door exploded open, followed immediate gunfire.
But it turns out he'd not done anything wrong. And now he's asking how often other innocent people get the SWAT team treatment. I'm Michelle Martin, the raid that went all wrong. Next time on Tell Me More.
That's on Tell Me More at 2 here on WAMU 88.5.
This afternoon at 1 on WAMU's HD Channel 3, it's the BBC's World Have Your Say. This live, interactive program lets listeners participate in international conversations about current events. You can contact them for more information about getting your questions on the air at worldhaveyoursay.com. Click on Contact Us. That's World Have Your Say, this afternoon at 1 on WAMU's HD Channel 3. Complete schedule information for HD Channel 3 is at WAMU.org.
Welcome back. I'm Rebecca Roberts, sitting in for Kodjo Namdi. We're talking with Tom Allen and Roger McBride Allen. They're the co-authors of Mr. Lincoln's High-Tech War. Please join our conversation at 800-433-8850 or email us, kodjo@WAMU.org. Let's take a call from Bruce in Mount Rainier, Maryland. Bruce, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. I'm very interested in this period and the music of it. I just completed a program with a group called Hesper, singing songs of the Lincoln era and songs that he liked. And one of the songs we featured was Richmond is a Hard Road to Travel, which was a broadside about the many failed attempts to capture Richmond. And I understand that when they first met in Manassas, people literally thought it was going to be a picnic and came with their picnic lunches to see the war begin and end in one battle. And regarding technology, when all of the weapons became more accurate and they eventually had repeating weapons, I wonder why, with his study of tactics, he didn't try to modernize the tactics so they just weren't mowing down each other in an open field.
Oh, okay, well... We could go about 4.5 hours on that topic. It's very, very, very complicated. The Lincoln is very much hands-on, but he's got to look at the strategic side of things, about the grand plan to operate it. While he is communicating with that colonel is the one who's running the tactics for that battle. Lincoln can't see what's going on. One of the huge basic things that happened is that there was a... smoothbore rifles or smoothbore guns were replaced by rifled muskets. The new weapons had 2 to 3 times the accuracy, 2 to 3 times the range of the weapons they replaced. The tactics everyone came to the war using had worked beautifully in the Mexican War 20 years before. They were based on both sides having weapons that were accurate to about 200 yards. There's a great quote from U.S. Grant saying someone could shoot at you from a smoothbore from 200 yards away all day and you'd never find it out. They simply weren't accurate enough. And so you could get your guys to within a couple of hundred yards of the opposing side, let off one last round of shot and rush them, and they would only be able to reload once, and maybe they'd hit you or not. Their weapons weren't very accurate. You get in there and finish them off with the bayonet. That was the basic tactics. All of a sudden in the Civil War, instead of a couple of hundred yards, you've got to start from a half mile back. And the guys shooting at you have a better weapon that can shoot further and faster. They can reload 2 or 3 times, and you've got 2 or 3 times as long to travel. And over again, these frontal attacks, everyone would be wiped out. Thousands and thousands of men, more men than have died in the Iraq War, routinely were killed in a single day. And no one understood this. No one got a hold of the tactics. But I can't put that on Lincoln's shoulders. That was the generals who were supposed to be working on that.
Well, it was also the man in charge of buying things for the Army really got into the problem of how you would have – he loved to have one kind of weapon that would be served by one kind of cartridge, and it would be one kind of repairs. It would be one manual. And when Lincoln would come in and say, hey, I found this guy who has a wonderful repeating rifle, the procurement officers would say, yeah, but we've got to set up factories. We've got to set up the training. It's just too much of a problem. And Lincoln would have to force his way through the red tape that had been set up by the Army. I mean, he was not the first nor the last president to learn that there's the Army and then there's logic.
But those procurement officers did have a point, too. Their logistic chaos wouldn't have helped anybody. There was a balance there, and they were too far in one end, but they did have a point.
This brings up an email from Christopher in Washington who says, did Lincoln's logistical approach to solving problems, his patent and interest in technology, inform and shape his approach to his administration and the problems encountered therein?
Well, I think one thing you can absolutely point to, and that is the discovery that you've got to have ironclad ships. I mean, overnight, every ship had to, no longer could have wooden sides. And that was an enormous technology that that he made sure was going to happen. He hung out at the Navy Yard. Mm-hmm. He would go down to the Navy Yard and just sit around and talk to people who were developing new cannon and the new ironclads that were coming into the war. He had a personal knowledge. How much he sent that out to people? Some people got it and some people didn't. Sheridan, wonderful general, didn't like the railroads because he had to defend them. And as you had said before, they could be torn up. He said, give me a river anytime. You send the boats down and they carry the supplies to where they're supposed to be. I don't like railroads. So there was something about getting the word out to the rest of the people, but he had the vision. And by the way, you know, in his spare time, he signs the legislation for the Transcontinental Railroad, the creation of the Homestead Act,
right.
and land grant colleges.
And I say that you can make a case he's a terrific peacetime president. What he accomplished in wartime for the peacetime United States was more than most presidents accomplished when there wasn't a war going on.
When you speak about the Ironsides, this is an email from Brian in Columbia Heights who says, many of the technologies we now rely on were developed by the military. It sounds like there was a similar role for the Navy during the Civil War. Do you see parallels from then to today?
I would have to say that's a bit of a stretch. The Ironside ships were absolutely only for wartime. And the interesting thing about that is that in the Civil War, they were the only example of something that was more or less invented during the war, that was put into use during the war, that had a major impact on the war. All the other funny gadgets that were invented once the war started really didn't reach the battle line and have a major effect on it. There were certainly a lot of improvements and enhancements and refinements to the railroads and the telegraphs and so on. And just the idea of mass production of everything, that was a huge effect. But as far as civilian use, a warship really didn't transfer much technology in the present terms.
Let's squeeze in one more call. This is Bill in Warrenton. Bill, welcome to the program.
Yes?
Yes, Bill. You are on the air.
Oh, okay. General Hooker at the Battle of Chancellorsville realized the importance of communication on the battlefield and had lines laid down so that he could communicate by telegraph instantly.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, old wires were used, and his perfectly sensible innovation ended up in confusion and perhaps became more of an impediment than an asset in that battle. So I'm wondering, in the case of Lincoln, where there are instances where perhaps his imperfect knowledge of technology or where in the application of technology unexpected results perhaps may have backfired on him.
Well, let me give you an example of something that didn't backfire. The Confederates very quickly learned you could tap telegraph wires. They could tap them, but they couldn't read them because the Union developed an incredibly complicated and wonderful cryptography system that resulted in not one single known message sent by Union telegraph being intercepted and broken by the Confederates, and the opposite is not true. Any time that they tapped into Confederates, they were usually able to read them.
That is Tom Allen, along with Roger McBride Allen. They are co-authors of Mr. Lincoln's High-Tech War, out from National Geographic. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Our pleasure.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Kojo Namdi Show. When we come back, we'll talk about the day Lincoln died in a moment. I'm Rebecca Roberts. Stay with us. Coming up at 1, Cosmic Connections. We find out how celestial events can directly affect our lives on Earth, from last week's meteorite to this week's comet. Today at 1 on the Kojo Namdi Show on WAMU 88.5.
Our HD Channel 2, Bluegrass Country, and our HD Channel 3, News Talk, is off the air while we upgrade our HD transmitter. So when you listen to an HD radio, you'll hear WAMU's analog signal on all three HD channels. We're working hard to upgrade our HD transmitter as quickly as possible, and the result of this upgrade will be a more stable HD signal. We regret any inconvenience. You can listen to all three of our HD channels online at WAMU.org.
Next time on Tell Me More, he was a small-town mayor living a quiet life, and then a county SWAT team raided his home, tied him up, and killed his dogs.
I heard my mother-in-law scream, then the door exploded open, followed immediate gunfire.
But it turns out he'd not done anything wrong, and now he's asking how often other innocent people get the SWAT team treatment. I'm Michelle Martin, the raid that went all wrong. Next time on Tell Me More.
That's on Tell Me More at 2 here on WAMU 88.5.
In our forecast for the afternoon, partly sunny skies, a rather breezy day with temperatures reaching 40 degrees for the high. Northwest wind gusts could be as high as 35 miles an hour. Now let's return to the conversation on the Kojo Namdi Show.
Welcome back. I'm Rebecca Roberts, sitting in for Kojo Namdi. It was an act of political violence more than 140 years ago, whose ramifications are still felt to this day, the assassination of President Abraham Lincoln. On April 14, 1865, John Wilkes Booth snuck into the president's box at Ford's Theater, shot the 16th president, bringing a fragile nation once more to the brink of chaos. The broad outlines of the plot are well known, but there are subplots and details that are still being uncovered. One of the people doing that uncovering is Anthony Pitt. He's the author of, most recently, They Have Killed Papa Dead, The Road to Ford's Theater, Abraham Lincoln's Murder, and The Rage for Vengeance. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And if you'd like to join us, call 800-433-8850 or send us email kojo@wamu.org. So we all learn about John Wilkes Booth and the dramatic assassination and jumping from the president's box onto the stage of Ford's Theater. But he was part of a conspiracy, the leader of something he had put together. There were other targets that night, and he had revised in his own mind what exactly he was going to do with or to the president. Give us sort of a little history 102 to add a little bit of details to the bare-bones story we all know.
Okay. In the beginning, Booth wanted to kidnap Lincoln and exchange him for captured Confederates because that was their Achilles' heel. They didn't have the manpower to match the North. Then he changed that plan when it went awry. They had the trap set, and Lincoln didn't turn up at that event. So he later changed it to a murder plot, assassination. And he figured that if he could rid the Union government of their leadership, then the Union government would collapse and the Confederate government would rise again. It was a pipe dream. It was all over. But he was a fanatic. He was obsessed with this. And so he delegated to two of his co-conspirators, one of them to kill the Secretary of State, William Seward, the other, at the precise moment he would kill Lincoln, would kill the Vice President, Andrew Johnson. Three top figures in the Union government were to be assassinated at the same moment on the same day.
Well, since this was after Lee's surrender at Appomattox and after President Lincoln's second inaugural, it seems more vengeance than strategy. Had the kidnapping plot happened months earlier, or had this been when there was still more hanging in the balance of the outcome of the war, it would feel more strategic. As it was, the timing just sort of felt... I think it's one of the reasons Booth is dismissed as a crazy man.
He was. He was because he was a fanatic. He was obsessed. He couldn't see the wood for the trees. And he couldn't see clearly. He was totally focused on ridding the man he called a tyrant. He wanted him removed by any means, including murder. And Booth was so self-assured, so self-confident. He did this in front of more than 1,600 people, and he almost got away with it. That's how audacious he was.
What is your sense of when he switched from a kidnapping plan to a murder plot? Was it that day when he realized that Lincoln would be at Ford's, or had he been sort of slowly changing his mind from the foiled kidnapping?
Oh, he had planned this long before, but he set it in motion as at noon when he saw in the newspaper that Lincoln would be at Ford's Theatre that evening. That was when he decided at that moment he would carry out the murder plot that night. And in other words, he didn't even have time to have relay runners with fresh horses or food and drink on his escape route. He just put it into motion without having secured all those kind of things that a carefully planned plot would require.
Well, he also had opportunity before that. He was close to the president at his second inauguration. And the executive mansion, as it was called then, not yet the White House, was open enough that an actor of his stature probably could have just had an appointment, but the president walked right in.
My book bulges, literally bulges, with new information. I spent 9 years on this book, and that mostly in the Library of Congress and National Archives. One of the things I found out early in my research, you said that Booth was at the second inaugural. I found out that Booth was in the rotunda of the U.S. Capitol. I have documentary evidence for this. Lincoln had attended the inauguration of his vice president, Andrew Johnson, in the old Senate chamber. Then Lincoln walked through the rotunda of the Capitol, and a man burst from the crowd within feet of Lincoln, behind Lincoln. He was restrained by Benjamin Brown French, one of the most notable figures in Washington, the top mason, commissioner of public buildings, chairman of the inaugural ball. And he grabbed this man, and he held him. And a policeman, a Capitol policeman, John Westfall, came over and helped him. And the man's eyes were blazing, and he had jet black hair. And then French had second thoughts. Maybe he's a new congressman, I don't know. I'd better release him. And he did. By then, Lincoln had gone through to the east front of the Capitol for his inauguration. 6 weeks later, Booth shot Lincoln. And French wrote in a letter that I found in the Library of Congress, he wrote to a relative, and that was the man that I restrained. So whether he was armed or not, I don't know. What his intentions or motives were never questioned, because he hadn't done anything to Lincoln. But that is a fact, that he was restrained, physically restrained, from approaching the president at the second inaugural.
I want to get back to French in a minute, because he was part of the city after the assassination and what happened then. But let's take a call quickly from Rick in Washington, D.C. Rick, welcome to the program.
Thank you for taking my calls. A great program, and you've had such informed guests. It's really mind-boggling, and thank you so much for bringing this important information. My question is two-part. It's about two different items that are missing, but they are very closely related, and that is the Civil War actually is billed as a war against slavery, but actually it was a war against to deal with two economic systems. One was slavery and one was capitalism, and how capitalism triumphed over slavery in that conflict. And the second is that something that is rarely ever mentioned, and that is that Lincoln, along with other presidents who dared to suggest that the United States government print its own money, were assassinated or attempts to assassinate them. These two items are never mentioned in the historian's remarks as it relates to that period and as it relates to Lincoln. And I hope that our most esteemed and informed guest now can address those issues. Thank you.
Rick, thank you for your call.
The second question is not within my field of expertise, but I can comment, because my field of expertise is the assassination and the aftermath. I can comment on the first question, which is, was it about slavery or preservation of the Union? Lincoln always said, he said at his first inaugural, addressing a secessionist at large, "You have no oath registered in heaven to destroy the government, while I shall have the most solemn one to preserve, protect, and defend it." he knew, as a very astute politician, that had he raised the issue of slavery, that this was to abolish slavery, he could never have secured, first of all, the support of the border states. They would have evaporated, that support would have evaporated immediately. And the Northerners would not have supported him, in my opinion, because they were not prepared for these horrendous casualties. Over 620,000 on both sides in a four-year brutal war. They would not have fought and lost those amount of casualties had it been about slavery. He knew he could hold the Union to get the support of the North and the border states if he concentrated on saying this is for the preservation of the Union.
So, as you mentioned, there were two other targets that night, Secretary of State Seward, Lewis Powell or Payne, went by a couple of names, attempted that. Seward survived but was stabbed. David Harold was supposed to be holding his horse, ran off instead. George Atzerodt was supposed to take on the vice president, and he chickened out, spent the night in drinking instead. So those were sort of the main conspirators, Booth, Harold, Powell, and Atzerodt. But there were others involved that had been part of the earlier kidnapping plan. In the aftermath of the assassination, as word got out that Seward had also been attacked, how did the city react? Did they think it was did they think Jefferson Davis was behind it? Did they think more was still happening, or did they think it was the act of a lone fanatic?
I'll tell you how terrifying it was to be in Washington that night. Lewis Payne, delegated to kill the Secretary of State, arrived at the Secretary of State's house 200 yards from the front door of the White House. The servant wouldn't let him in. They argued. He pushed the servant aside. He went up the stairs. He was stopped at the top of the third floor by the Secretary of State's son, Frederick. They argued for the same reason. Frederick went into his father's bedroom, came back, said, "Give me the medication." He refused. He turned to go down the stairs, and then the assassin wheeled around and fired his revolver. It jammed. He used the butt to smash it over the skull of this Frederick Seward. Then he charged into the room and pushed aside the 20-year-old daughter, Fanny, stabbed and wounded a male nurse, and lunged at the Secretary of State, mutilating his face, a cheek dangling from the knife wounds. And then the cries of the daughter woke up another son. Major Augustus Seward came running in. And he couldn't make out what was happening. The gaslight had been lowered, so the room was dimly lit. He grabbed the man he thought was his father, who was delirious. Then he realized by the strength and height of the man, it wasn't his father. So he and the wounded male nurse pushed the assassin out the door. He broke free, ran down the stairs, stabbed and wounded a State Department messenger in the back, fled out the door, dropped his knife in the street, jumped on his horse, and he escaped. They caught him 3 days later. Now, Alfred Cluffley, a clerk at the Treasury, had been walking his girlfriend in Lafayette Square in front of the Secretary of State's house and in front of the White House. And when he heard these cries, he ran into the Secretary of State's house, realized what had happened, ran down to the White House to sound the alarm. The guard said the president's at the theater. He didn't know which one, Ford's or Grover's. He ran towards Ford's. Halfway there at 13th and F, two men were running towards him, and he cried out. They cried out, "The president has been shot." He said, "No, the Secretary of State has been stabbed." And he did a double take. He was the first one to realize that there was a conspiracy to rid the Union government of its leadership. Now, that night, it was just like 9/11, because nobody knew what's coming next, who's behind it, what's the depth of the conspiracy. And that night, the only Washingtonians who slept were those who were already asleep. One of them, an academic, Simon Newcomb, his mother-in-law came running in, and he later wrote in his diary that his wife was hysterical when her mother announced the president had been shot. He coaxed her back to sleep. He said it's never happened before that a head of state here has been assassinated. She went back to sleep, and at 7:30 the next morning, they heard the bells tolling, and that's when they knew it was true. So people sat armed by their windows and doors with knives and weapons, expecting an uprising by Southerners who'd been planted here in great numbers to slaughter the inhabitants and burn the city.
My guest is Anthony Pitch. His book is They Have Killed Papa Dead, The Road to Ford's Theater, Abraham Lincoln's Murder, and The Rage for Vengeance. Let's turn to Patrick in Washington, D.C. Patrick, welcome to the Kojo Namdi Show.
Good afternoon. I'm really enjoying the show today.
Thank you.
I'm the chairman of the board of Congressional Cemetery, and I'm out in the yard standing at David Harold's grave at the moment. And I've been listening to your show at the same time, describing all the little nuances and pieces of everybody's story that helps fill in what was actually happening that day. I'm really enjoying reading your book.
Thank you. Are there things to see at Congressional Cemetery?
Excuse me?
Are there things to see at Congressional Cemetery? David Harold's grave is unmarked. What else is there?
Well, there's all sorts of people. In fact, in April, we're going to have a tour here that highlights the last day of Lincoln's life through the eyes of the people who were interacted with him that day. So we're going to have a tour starting with Charles Forge at the White House and carrying on through the tavern owner, Peter Taldeval, and the doorkeeper at the theater, and Benjamin French, showing what happened to the city. So we're going to sort of tell that story through the first-person eyes of people who were there that day.
I know Patrick well. Hello, Patrick. Patrick,
how are you doing?
Patrick is one of the worthiest Washingtonians. He is the driving force behind the move to restore many of these broken tombstones and make Congressional Cemetery much better than it has been. I even have a reference in my book when I'm talking about Washington in Lincoln's time, how baleful this place looked. One of the military judges who convicted the conspirators during the trial took a horse ride through Congressional Cemetery and noted in his diary the sad condition of the tombstones which were down. So even in those days, it was neglected.
Patrick, thank you so much for your call. He mentioned a tour in April at the cemetery. You also conduct tours through the city. If people want to sort of see local sites here in Washington that have to do with that day, we know about Ford's Theater. What are some lesser-known sites?
I do anecdotal history tours. I'm doing two for the Smithsonian Associates, the Lincoln Assassination Walk on the 11th of April and the 26th of April, and then I'll be doing one at the end of May, the same Lincoln assassination. So I start in front of the White House. I show where Lincoln gave his last speech, where Booth was in the massive crowd 3 days before the assassination, and Lincoln, for the first time, said black should be allowed to vote. And Booth turned to a co-conspirator and said, shoot him. And the man refused. He said it was too risky. They walked around Lafayette Square, and that was when Booth uttered his chilling vow in these words, that is the last speech you will ever make. And 3 days later, he shot him in the back of the head. So we go from there to Seward's house, to the home on Lafayette Square where Lincoln's theater guests were. Then we go to the Willard Hotel where the president-elect stayed for 10 days. We go to the theater where his son Tad was. That's where I got the title of the book, They Have Killed Papa Dead. Lincoln's 12-year-old son was at Grover's Theater, where the National Theater is today. He was watching a performance of Aladdin or the Wonderful Lamp with a White House staffer. Somebody dashed in and said the president has been shot. There was consternation and bewilderment until somebody stood up and said, this is a trick of the pickpockets. Everybody sit down. And then a third person went on the stage and said the news was true. Tad got back to the White House, and he ran up to the doorkeeper, Thomas Pendle, and he cried out, oh, Tom Penn, they have killed Papa Dead. And the next day, Tad was on the landing of a staircase in the White House, and the Secretary of the Navy, Gideon Welles, passed by, and Tad said, oh, Mr. Welles, who killed my father? And he couldn't answer, and he could not hold back his own tears.
They Have Killed Papa Dead is the name of the book. The author is Anthony Pitch. You can join us at 800-433-8850 or send us email kojo@wamu.org. We have email from Leroy in DuPont Circle who says, in the anger and violence that followed Lincoln's assassination, did the U.S. military ever take part in the attacks, or did they remain within the confines of law and maintain order?
The U.S. military, there were many, and I quote from their diaries and letters and even official reports, they restrained themselves from taking vengeance and actually slaughtering captive Confederates They found it very hard, the self-restraint, but they, without exception, they did restrain themselves. However, the mood throughout the country was so vicious, a visceral preference for revenge took over. And just to show you what it was like, there was an intellectual in Cleveland, Ohio. I got the letter that he wrote to the Chief Justice of the D.C. Supreme Court. And he said, quote, "Much as I have denounced the barbarity of the Spanish Inquisition, now I say, give us back the rack, so they shall feel its terrible rending powers and be glad to reveal all they know of damnable conspiracy." And one of the military judges, when he saw these prisoners, the suspects, brought into court on their first day, hooded, shackled, at their ankles and their hands. He later wrote in his diary, he shuddered in reminiscence. He said, "It was so much of what my imagination pictured the Inquisition to have been that I was quite impressed with its impropriety in our age."
What do you know about how the conspirators were treated once they were arrested?
There are parallels with what is alleged to be happening today. They were put into, this is before they were charged and 2 months before the verdicts came down. Each prisoner was put into a cell 3.5 feet wide by 7 feet long. They faced the opposite end of the neighboring cell so they wouldn't be able to see their neighbors or speak to them. And they had these tormenting hoods put over their heads, canvas hoods tied tightly around the necks and a slit to breathe through and to eat. And when they went into the court, the hoods were removed. As soon as they adjourned for lunch or after the trial, after that day's session, they would be led back to these drab, claustrophobic cells, and the hoods would be placed over them again. So the public demeanor of the prisoners gave no clue to their suffering. Few realized how the terrible strictures of confinement had begun to unbalance their minds. And after 6 weeks of this, the prison doctor doing his rounds reported to the prison governor. He said, quote, "If you don't take off these hoods, the Secretary of War is going to have a bunch of lunatics," unquote, on his hands.
What was the reason for the hoods?
The Secretary of War, Edwin Stanton, was a formidable, fierce man who looked as if he had been fashioned from cast iron. And he was determined to punish these suspects, not guilty, suspects, unforgivingly and mercilessly. And there was such outrage, even amongst Lincoln's first Attorney General Edward Bates. He later said that the military commission, military judges which were trying these suspects, he said, is unlawful. He said, "We are a government of laws, and the law is strong enough to rule us wisely and well." But they were overruled, and the Fifth Amendment was disregarded. The Fifth Amendment being that you have to rely on an indictment of a grand jury before they can answer to a crime or a capital crime. They disregarded that. They had the military trial instead of a civil trial. The reason being, in a military trial, you would only require a simple majority to convict and a two-thirds majority to hang. A civil trial mandated a unanimous decision of a jury, which they would never have got in wartime Washington because it was split between Southern sympathizers and Union devotees.
What do you attribute that sort of willingness to set aside the Constitution for all intents and purposes?
Rage. Lincoln was beloved. I think he's the only president you could use that word confidently. He was beloved.
Was he beloved when he was alive, or
yes,
was he instantly martyred?
He was not instantly beloved. When he arrived in Washington, the next day he went to St. John's Church for a service on a Sunday, and I have the diary of one of the men who was there, a worshipper, and he said, "Who is this ungainly, awkward Midwesterner who doesn't know how to talk, doesn't know how to dress, doesn't know how to walk?" They judged him by the cover, this lugubrious, melancholy-looking man. And very quickly he established himself as a wise, compassionate man with great humor. especially wisdom, and the manner in which he expressed himself so melodiously with wise feelings.
Well, it's interesting because when you read accounts of Booth's flight after the assassination, and he was so eager to read newspapers because he thought that there would at least be some sympathy for his act in the papers. And from all accounts, he was somewhat astounded that he was universally condemned.
He was flabbergasted. He wanted three things while he was on the run for 12 days. He wanted something to drink, something to eat, and the newspapers, which he expected to hail him as one of the greatest heroes of all time. He'd done the country a favor by ridding it of this tyrant. Instead, he found that even the Southerners were expressing sentiments such as 16 Confederate generals who immediately wrote that they had lost their best friend. People realized Lincoln, with his great magnanimity, at a time when most people were saying, let's hang the rebel leaders, Lincoln in his second inaugural, 6 weeks before he was shot, is saying malice toward none, charity for all.
Anthony Pitch, his book is called They Have Killed Papa Dead, The Road to Ford's Theater, Abraham Lincoln's Murder, and the Rage for Vengeance. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And a little postscript to last hour, we have an email saying the reason Jefferson did not patent his many inventions is because in Jefferson's view, all inventions should be used democratically for the benefit of all. Teddy then cites the book Thomas Jefferson, Father of Invention by Thomas Jewett. I'm Rebecca Roberts sitting in for Kojo Namdi Show. Join us in the next hour as we discuss the near universe. Stay with us. Coming up tomorrow on the Kojo Namdi Show, Tech Tuesday takes on the crime scene. Why a new report questioning fingerprints, DNA, and the like has many rethinking what goes on in your local crime lab. Plus, merging Quaker beliefs with practical experiences. How Anthony Benazet jump-started the 18th century abolition movement and helped end the American and British slave trades. The Kojo Namdi Show, noon till 2 tomorrow on WAM.